You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, bunch of brain buffs, embracing beefy, brilliant bits. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 257, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your meteoric, meat-cuting meatballs, meat-packing meters of meatloaf.
I'm Colin.
And I'm Chris.
So I have a another installment of our Let's Correct Ourselves segment, which is known as Actually.
Actually, what you said just wasn't true. Actually, do you mind if I correct you? Because actually, factually, and quite enthusiastically, I was right and you were wrong. That's exactly what inspired me to write this actually song. You were wrong.
I'm actually-ing myself because...
Self-report.
Takes a real man.
I was listening to our flat episode, and I had been reading about the malleability of different types of metals, and I had been reading about titanium and titanium jewelry, and I've been reading about tungsten jewelry.
Oh.
And I meant to talk about tungsten jewelry, but I said titanium instead. If you have a titanium ring and you hit it with a hammer, you are definitely not going to crack it. Obviously, it's made of titanium. Titanium, literally synonymous with a very, very strong metal. However, tungsten rings, I'm like, oh, this tungsten ring is so cool. They accidentally wrap it on a table or something and it just cracks. Titanium is not very malleable, but it's also not very brittle either. But tungsten is very brittle and will crack under compressive stress. So I meant to say tungsten.
I remember there was an influx of men's tungsten jewelry.
Yes. I was just going to say that.
Because part of the marketing is this is the strongest metal.
It is very strong. It is very strong, but it's very brittle.
Part of the allure that it was weighty.
Ooh. So it says here, tungsten is Swedish for heavy stone. Chris, I have to thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
On our way back from SporkleCon, me and Chris got to wait for our flight in a fancy airport lounge.
I was in the other terminal. I'm pulling up to the bar and I'm like, okay, I'd like a domestic beer, please. And like, here you go, $11.65. Then I'm getting texts from Karen and Chris. They're like, here's my falafel and fresh vegetables. And I got a little, oh, I haven't even hit the hot bar yet, you know? And it's like, oh, come on, what's going on?
Yeah. I'm drinking free beer I've never even heard of. Drinking like this, like German,
unlimited.
It was amazing.
So yeah, hope you guys had a good time there.
We really did. Thank you.
We did. We really did. Thanks to our credit card companies that gave us that perk. I mean, we were just killing time. I was doing New York Times crossword, and Chris was playing a weird game on his phone, and I've never seen it before. And I was like, what is that? It is also a New York Times game. Chris, what is it?
Oh, it's Connections. New York Times Connections. Yes.
Super Good Job Brain. The premise is you have 16 words and there are four categories. They don't tell you what the categories are. You just have these 16 words and you're trying to piece together and logic out what the four categories could be.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
It's fun.
Really urge everybody to try it. I think I enjoy it more than Wordle.
After playing Wordle a lot, it's like, it's just the same. It's the same game over and over and over again. But with Connections, because it has to be kind of like, carefully constructed and they can do clever things with it. It's always a different kind of challenge.
It's one of those games where you're smiling as you go through it. And like, even at the end, you're like, ah, I see what you did. And you're smiling. You know what I mean? Like it kind of has that payoff throughout the game.
Or you're really mad.
That too.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment. Pop quiz, hotshot. Here I have a box of random Trivial Pursuit game cards. You guys have your barnyard buzzers.
Your kids are going to inherit this bin of cards someday, Karen. They're going to be like, I don't know what my mom used these for, but they must have been really important to her for some reason.
They are. They are important. All right. Buzz in with the right answer. Here we go. Jumping in. Trivial Pursuit. This is copyright 2016. Blue Etra Geography. With over 35 million residents, what is the most populous city in the world?
Over 35 million residents, most
populous. Did that change? Oh, okay. Chris.
I was going to say Tokyo.
It is Tokyo.
It is. Nice. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. The last time I heard this stat, it's that like 1/4 of the population of Japan lives within commuting distance.
It's incredible. That's incredible. Correct as of the time of the card is all you're being held to. So
it is still correct. I'm just double checking now.
Oh, cool.
It is still number one.
What's number two?
Number two is Delhi.
Okay.
So 1, 2, 3, Tokyo, Delhi, Shanghai.
What's the highest North American city on the list?
Oh, interesting. Mexico City.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you mean U.S.?
I'm curious about U.S. too.
New York City.
All right.
Big Apple. Next question, Pink Wedge for pop culture. What is the full name of Australian boy band 5SOS?
Oh. All right, ready? Here we go. Us.
Okay.
Five Sons of Sydney.
Oh, that's a really good guess.
It is 5 Seconds of Summer.
Oh,
5 Seconds of Summer. Next question. Yellow Wedge, which sought after snack took 8 months to return to shelves after its parent company Hostess declared bankruptcy?
Oh,
Colin,
that's the Twinkie, right?
Yes, Twinkies made a comeback in 2013. Purple Wedge, next question. Which musical shares a title with a Def Leppard song, but the song does not appear in its production?
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Musical just shares a title song? With a Def Leppard song. Oh man.
Ready?
Yeah.
Sure. Rock of Ages. Rock of Ages, the Rock show Ages. Named after the song that's not even in the show. Even though the whole premise of the show
is that it's a jukebox musical.
Yes, 80s rock songs.
Yep.
All right, Green Wedge, what is the name of the astronomical tool created over 1,000 years ago and used to compute time and the position of the stars?
That is a sextant.
No, let me Dang read it. Again. What is the name of the astronomical tool created over 1,000 years ago and used to compute time and the position of stars? If you are a Game of Thrones fan.
Oh, is that an astrolabe?
Yes, it is an astrolabe. The spinny thing in the credits.
Yeah, you know, with the little cool kind of multi-piece.
It's actually an astrolabe.
Interesting.
All right, last question on this card. Orange Wedge, which quarterback set the all-time mark for most passing touchdowns in an NFL career in 2014?
Most touchdowns.
The most famous quarterback in 2014.
Yeah, man. Well, or somebody at the end of a very long career.
Tom Brady.
Incorrect.
The only one I know. No, that's not true. I know more. Do you want me to guess some more?
Yeah.
Peyton Manning.
Correct. It is Peyton Manning.
Yeah.
Nobody asked me any other quarterbacks.
That's it.
Two solid answers, including the right answer there. Yes. Yeah, excellent.
All right. Today's episode, Colin, our trusty topic picker, what'd you choose for us?
We got beef, which is all about arguments and disputes. And however you define tension, we got beef. With differences of opinion, I thought that would just be a great topic
or meat.
To explore. Yeah. Or hey, or just regular beef, you know, like we can traverse all avenues here on the show.
And so this week, we got beef.
So I was just reading about, right in our backyard, there is a somewhat famous example of something that I love, which is a spite house.
Oh, yeah.
There's something when people and neighbors get so petty, it almost becomes joyful and entertaining in a way. Yeah, just, yeah, how far are you willing to take your beef with your neighbor? So, yeah, a spite house, the idea being you are using your house as a thumb in someone's eye, as someone who did you wrong, you've got a gripe with, you're going to use your property. You know, a classic example is the person who puts up a 40-foot-high wall or an enclosure on their property just to block out someone's sunlight. Or just to make it just to take away their view.
That's so mean.
Or it's so, and there are examples of this around the country, around the world. There is a spite house very close to us. It was someone who had a piece of property that was radically diminished by the city of Alameda. They were expanding and building streets out there.
Oh.
A person named Charles Froling. He ended up with a strip of land, and he felt, apparently, the story goes, that his neighbor was really not very helpful in kind of resisting the city's fight, because the neighbor was kind of like, yeah, do what you want, doesn't affect me. So he had his house built on this strip of land. It's 54 feet long, it's 20 feet high, so two stories, and it's 10 feet wide. It is 10 feet wide at the base, and it is built right up to the property line. I mean, and it takes away the neighbor's sunlight. In fact, he even had a stained glass window facing out over the front door. It says,
oh no,
in case it wasn't clear, spite house. And now you can't build something like this anymore.
Really? Why not?
Just zoning restrictions and building codes. Like you're no longer allowed to do something like this. Like even as a, you know, a stunt, or even if you feel you've got a legitimate gripe, you have to have increased distances between your neighbors, and there's minimum sizes and things like that. So, but a lot of these spite houses that exist were grandfathered in because they were, you know, legal when they were built.
It looks so funny.
Yeah, it does. It looks like someone cut a house into thirds or a half. Yeah. And just dropped half of it. It's like, oh, it's like when you're playing SimCity, you know, and you've just got like this just ridiculously shaped building just because it fits the parcel of land or something. Yeah. But that is not the spite house that I wanted to share with you guys today. This spite house, this saga started in 2012. There was a woman in England with the absolutely fantastic name of Zippora Leal Mainwaring. Just fantastic, fantastic name. So she was 71 at the time of these events. She was a well-to-do developer. She bought a townhouse in Kensington, a rather upscale area of London, as you may know. Several million on this house she bought. And she wanted to turn this house from a three-story building into a two-story house and a two-level basement. Okay. Her neighbors were not happy with this plan. I think partially because of the noise, the dust and all that. And also partially, it sounds like in this neighborhood that she was in, they were very protective of the character of the neighborhood. So I'm just laying the groundwork here. So she had to file her plans. Like, I want to do this, get approval. Her neighbors were not helpful. They were very vocal in their...
But they can't really stop her from applying.
They can certainly show up at local council meetings and say, we don't want this to happen. You know, if it goes up for public comment, they can comment in the negative. As it turns out, the local council denied her application for the plans. All right. Now, Ms. Leal Mainwaring insisted that what happened next was not done as a troll job. By 2015, she ended up painting the house in big, bold, vertical red and white candy stripes, like the entire front of the house, like from the sidewalk all the way up to the roof, probably 8-inch, 10-inch wide red stripes. It made everyone so mad. People were so angry at this troll job. She was cited by the borough under the Town and Country Planning Act. Again, she was in trouble again. They gave her 4 weeks, said you have to paint your house back to white. Like, this is not acceptable. You're violating, again, the spirit of the neighborhood. All right, now I got to pause here for a second because I almost forgot my favorite part of this troll job is she painted it red, white, alternating candy stripes, but she left the last stripe unfinished. If you look up a photo of this house, you can see it's got, you know, a dozen or so red stripes across, and the last one goes up halfway and stops. And like, if I woke up as an angry neighbor, it's bad enough I have to look at these red stripes every day, but just, it would make me twitch that extra little bit that she didn't finish the last line. I know, I'd be like, oh, it's just, you're just twisting the knife there. Like, at least finish the stripe. She dug in her heels, and she said to the council, you know, like, no, you can't make me do this. This is my house. I don't really care what you all say. She appealed the decision to a higher court. She won her decision. So this was like 2017. She had spent years now sort of bickering with the local council and her neighbors over this red and white stripe house. She finally won the ability to do what she wanted with the structure. After all this, I think she had finally had enough of it. And she did, in fact, end up repainting the house to a much more modest color, partly out of feeling she had maybe proved her point, but partly out of, like, it was just a headache of people coming by and looking at it and giving her grief. The insistence on her part that it was just done out of the spirit of, like, levity to make the neighborhood a happier place and not trolling is what just makes it the perfect troll job in my eyes. A new way of thinking about a spite house.
If I were to do a spite house, or even just my regular house, if I were bold enough, I would do, like, paint the whole house in lime green so it can be used as a green screen. That'd be so funny. All right, let's get our brain juices flowing. I have a quick lightning round quiz.
All right, rubbing the brain.
We've talked about comic book villains before. Ooh. I have an obsession with Batman villains. I think the Rogues Gallery is so cool. I love their insane backstory or origin story. Colin, you shared about Paystack Pete. Crazy Quill is one of my favorites. Comic book culture and comic book stuff has become such a force in pop culture now.
Oh, yeah.
More so than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Definitely part of the zeitgeist now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So here, I have a quick lightning round quiz. Going to focus on the villains. The villains got beef with our beloved superheroes. I'm going to give you their real government name, and you tell me what their moniker is.
Okay. Okay.
These are all villains that had beef with a superhero at some point.
All right.
Buzzers at the ready. Lightning round. Here we go. Eddie Brock.
Oh,
Colin.
That's Venom.
Correct. Oroku Saki. Chris.
Shredder.
And a fun fact, wrestler/actor Kevin Nash played Super Shredder. in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. Secret of the Ooze.
Yep. That's Diesel. Remember your old WWF.
All right, here we go. Pamela Isley. Chris.
Poison Ivy.
Oh. Yes.
Norman Osborn. Colin.
Norman Osborn was the Green Goblin.
Correct. Next one, Eric Lemsher.
Eric Lemsher is Magneto from the X-Men.
Correct.
Oh.
His middle name is Magnus.
It's really convenient how, like, naming is destiny in the world of comics. You know what I mean?
Yes,
like, if your middle name is Magnus, you're going to have, like, magnet powers. That's just how it works. Yeah.
What about this one? Dr. Harlem Francis Quinzel. Chris.
Harley Quinn.
Correct. Wilson Fisk.
Oh.
Ooh, I've heard that.
Colin.
That is the Kingpin.
Kingpin.
Foe of Daredevil and Spider-Man to a lesser extent.
Okay, this one is funny. Alexander Joseph Luther.
Oh.
Chris.
Lex Luthor.
Yes, it's Lex. Lex is short for Alexander.
Yeah. Alexander.
Yes, yes. Julian Gregory Day.
Julian Day. Oh, is
Colin?
Is Julian Day? Is that Ozymandias?
That is Calendar Man from Batman.
Day,
of course.
Julian Gregory Day. Very good. Yes. Next one, Emil Blonsky.
Oh.
Emil Blonsky.
Played by one of my favorite actors, Tim Roth. It is, if you watch She-Hulk, it is Abomination. Oh. Abomination. Okay, next one, Jonathan Crane. Chris.
Scarecrow.
Correct. Cletus Cassidy.
Mm.
It is Carnage. Okay. Darren Cross.
Oh, Darren Cross. Man, why do these all sound so familiar?
If I gave you the superhero name, it's impossible to think of their real name.
Darren Cross.
Ross.
Villain in the Ant-Man universe.
Like Yellow Jacket? Was that what
Yes,
it was?
Yellow okay. Jacket. Yellow Ooh, Jacket. Okay. All right, last all right. one. Kane Marco.
What villains have not come up yet, I guess.
Kane Marco is better known as Juggernaut. I just never thought he was like a person. There is humanity.
Yeah. Dude, just a man wearing a really weird piece of armor. Yeah. Julius Day. Calendar Man. Incredible.
Julian Gregory Day.
Yes, as in the Gregorian calendar.
Yep.
You feel like once you see it in retrospect, like, yes.
It's a real it's a real face palm. Yeah, okay. It's a chef's kiss face palm name.
Chef's kiss face palm.
It's like when you hiccup and sneeze at the same time. You have to find a way to,
It's just really uncomfortable. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
You're listening to Good Job Brain. Smooth puzzles. Smart trivia. Good Job Brain.
And we're back. This week, we got beef. Who's got beef next?
I have some beef for you guys because I did not hear. I'm very literal. So when, Colin was like, this is all about beef, I'm like, great. As in meat that comes from cows. Fantastic. I love doing food segments. And it just instantly, I could think of nothing other than I wanted to do something about regional beef sandwiches.
Yes.
The United States of America. Because Americans, no matter what, America's a big country. America's a very diverse country. America is like 50 different countries, culinarily speaking. But we all love our beef sandwiches. We've just arranged it into many similar but ultimately very different types of sandwiches. Now, of course, the most important thing when you're doing a quiz like this is to come up with a really good title.
Agreed.
At first, I was like, I'll call it regional beef, which is pretty good. I started thinking about like, oh, let's like call it like, where's the beef? Like, where is it? Or like, where's the beef from? Then my brain kind of went to like, oh, beefing from coast to coast or something like that. And then, lightning struck and I was inspired, that is why the title of this quiz is Beefing USA.
Everybody's on beefing.
Beefing USA.
This is the joy of working with Chris Kohler, is you get bespoke cover theme songs. All right, got my new ringtone now.
There you go. Okay, so anyway, let's get into it. Beefin' USA, the hottest new game show. 10 questions, all about regional beef sandwiches. Right.
You guys know I have the Wikipedia sandwich list bookmark.
And you've had your state marathons, Karen. So I feel like you've been training for this moment your whole life.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So the fun thing is that, of course, this being America and these being like these hyper regional sandwiches, so layers on layers here, there's sometimes beef about the beef. You know what I mean? So there's sometimes fights over, you know, the beef sandwiches. So I'll let you know if there's any beef. Yeah. Happening here as we go through. Beefception. Grab those buzzers. Number one, despite its name, what famous beef sandwich originated in Los Angeles in the early 1900s? Karen.
The French dip.
The French dip, yes.
Thin roast Colin, beef. I thought you were going to snag that from
LA. Second too late. I was half a second behind you. Yep.
Thin roast beef generally served on a French baguette. With jus, with the thin gravy.
Yeah.
The beef around this sandwich, and Colin, maybe you know what the beef is here. There's two restaurants in LA that both claim to have invented the French dip sandwich. You have Cole's and Philippe's.
Oh, I love a good French dip sandwich.
French dip, yes. Next question. Originating in Iowa and also known as a tavern sandwich, what sandwich made with ground beef shot to national fame when it was featured extensively on the sitcom Roseanne? Karen was in a little bit early.
Sloppy Joe's.
Yeah. Incorrect.
Oh.
It is not the Sloppy Joe.
Okay.
Colin, you want to take a
No,
stab at this
I was going to say Sloppy Joe too. Maybe
it's not the Sloppy
beef.
Joe. Okay. It is the loose meat sandwich. The loose meat sandwich.
Yes. How can
very well known in the Midwest. Yeah, yeah. It is ground beef with sauteed onions, like all mixed together on a bun. It's like a Sloppy Joe, but it
no
does
sauce.
Not have any slop.
Got
there's
it.
No slop. It's
it.
Seasoned and it's flavored, but there's no slop. Yep.
Okay. It's less right. wet.
Yes, they opened up in Roseanne, they opened up a loose meat, you know.
Oh.
Diner, basically. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Next question. Buffalo, New York, well known for its chicken wings, but also for a particular beef sandwich. In fact, the national chain Buffalo Wild Wings was originally called BW3 or Buffalo Wild Wings and blank.
Oh.
Whoa.
Buffalo Wild Wings.
Buffalo Wild Wings and blank. Or BW3.
Something W.
As a solving whoa, whoa, whoa. Aid. Do
as
you know
a,
this?
Wellington.
East Coast.
No, Wellington. Interesting guess. Wellington. This is a Buffalo area thing. They've got it up in Rochester as well. The sandwich is called Beef on Weck. Beef on Weck, WECK. So Buffalo Wild Wings was originally called Buffalo Wild Wings and Weck.
Wow.
What is Weck?
Weck refers to a Kummel Weck roll. And Kummel Weck is a roll that is topped with salt and caraway seeds. The Kummel is caraway seeds. If you're in Buffalo or Rochester, this is served
That's
everywhere.
The...
Very, very famous.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. How about
great.
That?
I love it.
Staying in the great state of New York, if you were to make the New York City bodega sandwich known as a chopped cheese, you would begin by putting what on the grill?
I thought the chopped cheese was like just meat and cheese, basically. I thought that was pretty much all there was to
it. But what do you put first on the grill? That's the...
I see what you're saying.
What is the major like ingredient that this starts with?
I'll say cheese.
The answer is a preformed burger patty. So the chopped cheese is made not with like putting ground beef onto the grill.
It's like a pre-formed. Taking
like a frozen burger patty, which would ordinarily be made to make burgers, and putting that on the grill and then letting that, you know, develop a crust and then chopping it.
Got it. Okay.
Chopped cheese, you know, very well known in the New York City bodega scene. Almost entirely unknown outside of that. Incredibly good, though, when made correctly. If you, let's travel a little further south. If you were to walk into a steak sandwich establishment in Philadelphia and ask for Whiz-Wit, what two toppings will your sandwich have on it?
It would have cheese whiz, uh-huh, like spread, and uh-huh, it would have peppers.
Incorrect.
Onions.
Mm. Onions is, yeah, correct. Whiz-Wit is short for whiz-wit onions.
With
peppers or mushrooms or stuff like that would be, you'd have to call that out specifically.
That's a higher tier of.
But they ask you if you want it with or without. They're asking about the onions. Now, of course, there are lots of beefs over the Philly cheesesteak.
Yes.
Whether or not Geno's or Pat's is the best steak in Philly. But also the ongoing debate over whether the canonical cheese on a cheesesteak should be cheese whiz, as in the processed cheese sauce, versus provolone. Because there's a lot of people who would tell you a real Philly cheesesteak would use sharp provolone cheese. But then, of course, a lot of people would tell you a real Philly cheesesteak uses cheese whiz, and we're not going to be able to resolve that here.
We are not taking a side.
Next question. The character Tracy Turnblad sings "Good Morning" to this city, which boasts its own regional beef sandwich known as the pit beef. Karen.
Good morning, Baltimore.
Good morning, Baltimore. Opening number in the musical Hairspray. Yes.
Very nice.
Baltimore's sandwich, the pit beef, contains charcoal-fired roast beef with onions, ooh, and horseradish sauce.
Ooh.
Yeah. Next question. The website emeralds.com features a roast beef variation of this sandwich.
Roast beef emerald.
Oh,
Colin.
Is it a muffaletta?
It is not a muffaletta.
Oh, I'm going to guess po' boy.
Correct. It is a po' boy. Okay. Yeah, could have gone either way on that one. Emeralds.com being the website of Emeril Lagasse, famous for his Creole cuisine of New Orleans. Yes. The beef, by the way, the fight over the po' boy of late is how you spell it. AP style, the Associated Press says P-O apostrophe boy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But many New Orleanians spell it without an apostrophe at all, just connecting it together.
Oh, just P-O?
Or with a dash, like po'boy, with no punctuation at all, or po-dash boy. There was a big fight over that. Again, did not really get resolved. Pittsburgh's regional beef sandwich, usually made at restaurants like Primanti Brothers, is full of beef pastrami, tomatoes, cheese, coleslaw, and what?
Oh,
Aaron.
Oh.
Like fried onions.
It is not fried onions.
Oh, wow. Man. Oh, french fries.
That's what you were getting at. Yes. The classic Pittsburgh sandwich has pastrami.
And they're tall. I just remember them being really tall.
Well, when you're stuffing a big fistful of french fries in the sandwich, then it tends to get pretty big. The coleslaw makes it kind of slippery too. It's a real challenge.
A two-hander, as they say, right?
Yeah. So, speaking of which, next question: an open-faced sandwich that is built of Texas toast, a beef patty, French fries, and cheese sauce, called the Horseshoe, was created in what city? The city is the last one Abraham Lincoln lived in before he moved to the White House.
Okay. So.
Karen is buzzed in.
It's going to be Illinois. So it's going to be either Chicago or where he lived, like Springfield. Springfield.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Springfield, Illinois is it.
Yes.
Springfield, Illinois.
Nice.
Home of the regional beef sandwich known as the Horseshoe. Again, that is Texas toast on the bottom, a beef patty, a big pile of french fries, and then cheese sauce. It's an open-faced sandwich. It is technically still a sandwich. I would not call the Rochester garbage plate a sandwich because there is no, you can't make a sandwich out of it, but the Horseshoe.
It just sounds like a bunch of burger stuff, but all in one plate.
It's more efficient, though, Karen. Doesn't have that top bun to slow you down. You just get right down to business with the horseshoe. Yeah. Just the way Honest Abe would like it.
And final question. Of course, two different bars in Minneapolis both lay claim to the invention of this rhyming sandwich that features cheese stuffed inside a burger patty.
Rhyming sandwich. Parrot.
You buzzed in with authority.
I believe this is called a Juicy Lucy.
Oh, my goodness.
You are correct. It is the Juicy Lucy.
Karen, you're playing this game on another level. I cannot hang with your sandwich knowledge. This is amazing. The Juicy Lucy.
The Juicy Lucy. And the beef over this, you'll love this, Colin. The beef over the Juicy Lucy. Of course, there's two bars, which are both, you know, say that they invented it with no help from anybody else. The two bars are Matt's Bar and the 5-8 Club. At Matt's Bar, the sandwich is spelled J-U-C-Y-L-U-C-Y. So Juicy is misspelled.
Okay.
Whereas at the 5-8 Club, Juicy is spelled with an I. And at the 5-8 Club, they have the motto, if it's spelled right, it's done right. Whereas, apparently at Matt's Bar, they have the motto, if it's spelled correctly, you are eating a shameless ripoff. So I don't know. Again, I'm not getting involved. It's great for them. Congratulations.
I'm surprised there's not a third cheese-filled burger outfit and they call it Juicy, spelled J-U-I-C-Y, and then Lucy, L-U-I-C-Y.
There should be. Maybe we should start that.
Just room to horn in on the market.
Juicy and Lucy. Yeah.
We're just forming the Juicy Lucy district at that point. Yeah.
Right.
That's, I love that you found the beef over the beef. Like, that's it's fantastic. Yep.
Well, anyway, thank you all for playing Beefin' USA. Everybody had cheese across the USA. Then everybody'd be beefing like Philadelphia. You'd see a meeting to lose meat. Hurls before boy do. Juicy Lucy and friendship. Beefing USA.
I know that you probably spent as much time on that as everything else combined, and I just want to say, well worth it. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Would not do it differently.
I did the little title, the stinger thing, like this morning when we're getting the kids ready for school, and I absolutely didn't have the time to do it, but I did it anyway because I couldn't get it out of my head. And then by the time that I was done with work and came home, the Philadelphia thing, I'm like, I have to do this. So now everybody has to make theme songs for your quizzes.
Y'all, you know, I am very tuned in on lobster news.
Oh, yeah.
I've talked about lobsters extensively on the show. I want to ask you two, just when you picture a lobster in your head, like in the ocean, in the water, how would you describe lobsters moving?
Oh, no.
Kind of just crawling along. Sort of just at a stately pace.
Not doing a lot of moving, just sort of chilling on the bottom and like the mob boss in Goodfellas, like, you know, only as fast as they have to.
This will come back. In 1960s, many African nations that were under the French colonial rule were becoming independent, right? Mm. Which also means that there is less ocean area in Africa for France's fishing industry. A lot of the French seafood supply became limited, especially lobsters. And they're like, we got to go find more lobsters. So the French sent large fishing vessels to explore and look for potentially more lobsters. And boy, did they find them. They found some hotbeds of lobsters, about 100 miles off the coast of Brazil.
That's a long way from France.
Yes, it is a long way from France. And Brazil got pissed. Hey, these are our lobsters. What are you doing near us? But are they actually Brazil's lobsters? So Have you heard of the continental shelf? Do we know what that is?
Yeah.
The continental shelf. It's the stretch of the seabed adjacent to the shores of a country.
Yeah.
So let's say you're going to a beach, right? You go to the beach, you go into the water, and then you kind of swim out. And then you notice that all of a sudden the seafloor drops significantly, yeah, right? So the continental shelf is pretty much everything up to that point before you get the big hole drop. And so, yeah, the stretch of seabed that is adjacent to the shores of a particular country. So the Geneva Convention granted nations the right to all resources, including plants and animals, if they are in constant physical contact with the continental shelf of the country, which means
okay,
everything within this the seabed area belongs to the country. Maybe there is a, you know, seaweed that's growing off a beach in Japan. That seaweed is owned by Japan. So Brazil says lobsters crawl. They're like oysters. They cling to the bottom of the floor and that's where they move. Therefore, in constant contact with the continental shelf. So these lobsters are Brazilian property, right? French were like, no, lobsters are like fish. They swim. They swim about in the open sea.
Frolicking hither and yon.
Yeah, they cannot be considered as part of the continental shelf. And that was the beef. This weird argument of how do we classify the movement of lobsters? This went on for like 2 years. Brazil sent out a fleet of 6 destroyers and patrol boats to kind of like shoo away, to drive away all the foreign, the French boats. And they actually captured 3 French ships. So then the French send a destroyer on their own. Nothing's really happening, though. They're still fixated on how do we define how lobsters move.
Of whether they touch the ground, yes, when they move or not. This, oh,
and
my God.
So, yeah, and Brazil brought in an oceanography expert into its all diplomatic right committee. So it's this oceanography expert. He said something really funny. The Admiral Paulo Moura da Silva. To say that the lobster is like a fish whenever it comes off from the seafloor to swim is like saying a kangaroo becomes a bird whenever it hops into the air. The conflict started in 1961. Finally, there was an agreement in 1964. And how was the dispute resolved? No shots fired, no war, kind of anticlimactic. Basically, Brazil extended its territorial waters.
And like, I still feel like I need to go and like do my own observation here now.
Like,
and,
like, how get down do there to lobsters see move?
Yeah.
Calling all kids in the car. Brittany and Meredith here from the chart-topping Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Are you dreading another silent car ride with the fam? We've got the cure. 3 rounds of fresh trivia every single week. Movies, music, even science and Disney. We've got something for every trivia buff in the car. No more crickets chirping on those long journeys. Yay! The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast is your secret weapon for connecting and laughing with kids of all ages. Teens, toddlers, adults, it doesn't matter. Spark their curiosity and challenge their brains with every episode. New episodes drop weekly wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast and turn those car rides into epic adventures.
We got one last segment. Colin, where's the beef?
The beef, we're going international. Chris has beef in USA. We're gonna take the beef around the world.
Yeah.
I love Karen. I this is a great segue here, and we don't coordinate these, I swear. But I love the international beef you've described here. I, in particular, am very fascinated with border disputes.
Oh, yeah. And they get petty, too.
So petty over sometimes the least desirable pieces of land. It just becomes such a matter of principle and national pride. And sometimes it leads to some very funky outcomes. There are a lot of border disputes that end, or at least have shooting wars involved. There's a lot where there's a lot of bloodshed. I wanted to find a few examples of things that have turned out in unusual ways, let me put it. So I got a few examples here of border disputes and how they have sort of settled or not, maybe not quite settled. So we're going to go way north to start here. We're going to go to a very tiny little chunk of land called Hans Island. Tiny, uninhabited, cold chunk of rock. It is in the middle of the Nares Strait, separating Canada and Greenland.
Oh, okay.
So it's way, there. Way, way up there by Nunavut. And for many years, there was an active, somewhat good-natured dispute over who owns this little chunk of land where no one lives there. Like maybe some birds land there occasionally. No one lives there. Traditional people in the area, the Inuit, were well aware of it, but there were no resources on there. It was uninhabited. And so the Canadians were like, hey, yeah, that's obviously our island. Greenland, essentially controlled as an extension of the Danish government's like, yeah, that's our island, actually. It's funny that you think that. In 1984, things took a little bit of a turn here, and it was the start of what they call the Whiskey War, okay? Some soldiers from Canada had traveled to the island. They planted a Canadian flag, and they left a bottle of Canadian whiskey behind.
Okay.
And made it known that they had done this. So later that year, the Danish Minister of Greenland Affairs, because I cannot let this stand. So the minister traveled out to Hans Island, left a Danish flag, left a bottle of Danish schnapps, and like a note that basically said, hey, you know, welcome to Danish territory. You know, thanks for visiting Hans Island. Over the following years, it kind of continued somewhat in this vein. Like it was sort of open, public, it's kind of jocular. And, you know, like you would see representatives from the countries, like, you know, talking about it, like answering questions at a press conference. They're always just kind of smiling and laughing when they talk about it. Like, oh, yeah, you know, at some point, I'm sure we'll settle this. It's our island, though, for real. Like, just to be clear, it's our island. You know, like they always make sure to end with like, just to be clear, it's our island. So finally, in 2022, all right, just happened in large part as a show of how nations can solve problems amicably, you know, sort of against the backdrop of Russian invasion and things going on.
Yeah.
You know, if we can put our differences aside over this little piece of land, then other countries can do the same.
But there are no stakes.
Yeah, exactly. It had also just been going on for a very long time, and they're extremely low stakes. So yeah, representatives from the Danish government, the Canadian government, they got together. They basically split the island in half.
Oh my God.
It's not exactly 50-50. Denmark / Greenland got the bigger chunk, so they fared out better. They got about 60% versus 40% to Canada. But most importantly, everybody is happy. No shots were fired. Nobody was hurt or killed or lost or anything like that.
I have a question.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
This rock, they split it in half. So like here's the line in the middle. This is Canada. This is Greenland / Denmark. Does that mean they border each other now?
Yes. So Karen, there've been
So this
is what I love about the story. So it created some really interesting new trivia here. So for one, this island is now the third shortest land border between any two countries. And it established a second land border for Canada, which previously only had a land
border
had
the US.
With the US, that's right. And it established a second land border for the Danish realm as well, which previously only had a border with Germany. That's right. So now each country, each realm now has another additional land border. It is also apparently the northernmost international land border in the world.
Oh, I want to go.
Yeah.
It's made it cooler now. They've made it cooler.
It is cooler. If someone could open up a gift shop there and sustain it. Yeah. Good luck. Good luck to them up on, on Hans Island. So let's travel a little bit. We're going to go south, a good bit south, in fact, to Pheasant Island. Like the bird, pheasant. Island. Now, Hans Island is tiny. Pheasant Island is minuscule. Pheasant Island is 660 feet long. It is 130 feet wide. And it sits right in the middle of the Bidassoa River, which forms the border between France, and Spain. It is an eroding, uninhabited, just little chunk of dirt and trees and land. Very small. No one lives there. It is, as I say, it's right in the middle of the river. And often when there's land in a river, it's pretty clear which side of the river it's on. Generally speaking, if it's past the midline, it goes to one country. If it's past the other midline. But this one's right in the middle. This is my favorite solution to a potential border dispute. Rather than fighting about Pheasant Island with guns or soldiers or whiskey or schnapps, France and Spain take turns running Pheasant Island. Every 6 months, control of Pheasant Island alternates between the government of Spain and the government of France. And they just do it in a very orderly way. There is an official schedule, and every 6 months changes over. It sounds like in practice, though, on a day-by-day basis, Pheasant Island is effectively run by the mayors of the two towns closest to it on either side of the border.
Do they? I wonder if they have a sign or a light that tells you
currently under control of...
Yeah. Oh, how cool would that be?
That would be pretty cool, actually. Yeah, I looked at some pictures of it. I can't say it's a very impressive-looking parcel of land. All right. I want to close here with this to me really felt like a Good Job Brain story. This is a border dispute that has created a very interesting turn of events in the world. I want to tell you guys about a region of land known as Bir Tawil. And this is a pocket of land, very small. And it sits right on the border between Egypt to the north and Sudan to the south. Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a real dime store thumbnail history of the region. In 1899, the local government of Egypt and the United Kingdom, which up to that point had, you know, been a major power in the region, colonial power, were essentially deciding on the line of demarcation between what would be Egypt or what would remain Egypt and what would be Sudan. And they agreed, as countries often do, they chose a line of latitude. And they said, all right, the 22nd parallel... The 22nd parallel, right, it's already pre-decided. We don't need to survey it. This will be the border. Like, anything above the 22nd parallel is Egypt. Anything below the 22nd parallel is the region of Sudan at the time. Great. Seems at least very unambiguous and easy just to decide. Nice straight line, runs all the way out to the Red Sea. Boom.
Yep.
Right? Okay. Rather than leave well enough alone... 3 years later, the UK government drew up a separate, quote, administrative boundary map. The goal of this map was to sort of recognize the facts on the ground of how the land was actually being used by the peoples who lived in those regions. Just to throw a wrench in the works here, it did not follow the same line as the 22nd parallel line. All right, so it was not a nice straight line. The new line in this administrative boundary went most of the way straight, and then it kind of dipped south a little bit below the 22nd, just for a little chunk, came back up. That little chunk is Bir Tawil, and we'll talk about this in a second. Then it went up a good bit to the north of the 22nd parallel and enclosed another chunk of land called the Halaib Triangle, substantially bigger and substantially more desirable and bordering the Red Sea. This really complicated things because now both countries wanted access to the Halaib Triangle. They both wanted this nice big chunk of land, which was already sort of nominally in Egypt's mind. So they basically didn't agree, and they kept fighting about it. After the independence of Sudan in the 1950s, continued fighting about it. To this day, it is disputed. And here's where it gets really interesting. So Egypt wants to recognize the 22nd parallel line. And they say, we clearly own the Halaib Triangle, the big area. We do not care anything at all about Bir Tawil. That's your territory, Sudan. Sudan wants to stick to the administrative boundary, the one that goes up and down and gives them the Halaib Triangle. But in order to claim that, they have to renounce control over the region called Bir Tawil because they don't want it. And if they say they take it, they are in effect agreeing to the 22nd parallel boundary.
Okay.
So this dispute has created a situation where there is a tiny little pocket of land below the 22nd parallel. Neither country wants it. They don't want to put people there, develop there, or lay any claim to it. So it is one of the very few areas on the entire planet that is not claimed by any country.
By any country.
It's not claimed by any international state. This little kind of four-sided region, and neither country wants it because to claim it means
you have to give up the bigger space,
give up the bigger side.
So, well, then what about the triangle?
I don't want to say it's de facto Egypt territory, but it is above the 22nd. Mm-hmm. I think Egypt currently exerts the most control over it. Let me put it that way. Yeah. It's disputed. And if you go look even on, you know, Google Maps or Google Earth, you'll see that it's drawn in a little bit different line there. You can see the larger Halaib triangle. And then you can see this tiny little chunk that's the Bir Tawil region. Neither country wants the small one. They're like, nope, it's up for grabs.
We should go get it.
We should go
I know.
Plant our flag and a bottle of whiskey and come up with a beef sandwich. Yeah.
When I name myself glorious president for life.
And that's our show. Thank you all for joining me. And thank you, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about Loose Meats, The Lobster War, Pheasant Island, Spite Houses, and comic book villains. You can find us on all major podcast apps and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like The Explorers Podcast, Movie Therapy, and Plotting Through the Presidents. And we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.